Just moving your head is good because it was getting in the way. Start at the bottom. The
word Veda, this is Vedic Vision Society, yes? That's the name of the club? So Veda means knowledge, and the Vedic wisdom or Vedic literature covers, it's like an encyclopedia or like a university that has so many different departments of knowledge. And one might be surprised that one of those departments of knowledge is relationships. And from that body of literature, the ancient wisdom of India, I'm going to be discussing what it has to say about relationships. And I thought of the title, Currency of Relationships. Currency normally is thought of in terms of finance, not in terms of relationships. So it's kind of like currency doesn't fit in with relationships and relationships don't fit in with currency. So I put the two together on purpose. And you'll see why. And then a little bold step forward with that currency of relationships is a value judgment in one sense, pure and impure. So let's see where we go with this. This is a painting of two personalities, Rupa Goswami here, and his elder brother Sanatan Goswami. And this, what I'm going to explain comes from their writings. And a little bit of background on these two personalities. Around the time when Christopher Columbus was finding out that the world wasn't flat, it was actually round, he got in his three boats, or his group of people and finding America. So around that time of history, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and his followers, including Rupa and Sanatan, were living in India. And they were divulging to the world the highest truths of spirituality through the Vedic literature. And by their vast, previously they were prime minister and home minister of about half of what India is today. It's a long story, but to make it short, they weren't interested in that. Some people, they make their whole life just to get that. They had that and they left it for a life of spiritual simplicity. They went to live in Vrindavan, which is the place where Krishna made his appearance. It's a holy place. And living as mendicants, they dedicated their lives to expanding on the Vedic wisdom and the explanation of it that they heard from Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to provide literatures that explain the science of and the art of a life in devotion. So that's where this is taken from. So I'm giving credit to Rupa especially. Rupa Goswami wrote literatures on the science of devotional service. And we'll start just with very simple definition. What's a relationship? So practically a dictionary definition type of thing is relationship is the common basis of interaction between two or more people. So there's two people, a green one and a brown one. And they're interacting with one another. And there's some basis of their interaction between one another, and that's what the relationship is. So this term now, common basis, indicates a commodity of exchange or currency that all parties agree on. So those are business terms. Commodity of exchange or currency. So somebody has something, somebody wants something, and that happens not only in the business world, it happens in relationships. Somebody has something, there is something, and somebody likes that something, and they value it. And so because there's a shared value of something that they agree upon, there's then some relationship. So there's where the currency is. So what's the common basis? Without a common basis, there's no way of relating. There's no relationship, or you can call it a relationship, but it's a dysfunctional relationship. So there must be some common basis. And then exchange is, there's a subject and an object, and sometimes the roles of subject and object alternate. And these terms, subject, object, are taken directly from the Vedic literature, and I'll explain it in this way. The object, there's a baby crib. You don't see the baby, but he's there. And he's the object of the affection of the other family members. And then the other family members, they're the subject who are feeling something towards the object. And then, so when there's a relationship, then there's an alternating position of subject-object. One who is having feelings towards the other, and then vice versa, one who is having feeling towards the other. Like in a discussion, somebody says something and somebody listens, hopefully. And then that person who is listening, when they reply, hopefully the other person will also listen. And so the subject-object role is vacillating back and forth. But then there's something that's in between that they mutually value. It's not just subject matter. There are roles that are alternating, and then there's something that's being exchanged. And what's that something that's exchanged that they both value? It's emotion, primarily. You know, whatever they're saying to one another. There's some emotion connected to what they're saying. And that's the something that they value. That's the currency in that relationship. And they're exchanging emotion. So now, the science of relationships from the Vedic literature says, and this is really a simplification because it can be expanded, but emotion has eight kinds. There's primary emotion of love, and then there's secondary emotions that have subsets to those secondary ones. And the words are in Sanskrit, but the English translations are amazement, humor, chivalry, compassion, fury, fear, and dread. Now, those seven, the secondary ones, don't have any place unless there's a primary one. And the secondary ones are secondary to the primary ones. So we're going to first look at the primary ones, love. And that primary emotion of love, the Vedic literature describes, is of five different types of moods or emotion: neutral, servitude, friendship, parental, and conjugal. And these pictures are supposed to illustrate examples of them. We'll break them down one by one. But first, just to remind you what we're speaking about, there's a loving relationship, there's the object, that little baby in the crib, invisible baby, and then there's the subjects, feeling something towards the object. So the subject feeling towards the object has both character and quality. So we'll go through the character part first. Here's a group of students sitting in a classroom, just like, you know, you sign up for a class and it's the first day of the semester, and you all sit down in your seats and you don't know each other, but the commonality that you share is you're all students in the same classroom. So it's kind of neutral. And some time passes, and you drop your pen or your eraser, or a piece of paper falls on the floor, and the person says, oh, you know, here you dropped your pen or your paper or your eraser. Oh, thank you very much. So there's some service exchange. But move from neutral to some service. Or you're sitting taking an exam and you don't know the answer to question number four. What's the answer to question number four? So, oh, thank you very much. So service exchanges can follow from neutral. So that's the service part, just as an illustration. And as service increases in intimacy, it can become friendship. Just like, for example, someone's the chauffeur of a big man. And every day the chauffeur drives the big man to go to work. And of course of time, the chauffeur starts some exchange and he's treated like a friend. It's just like he knows everything about the big man, and the big man knows everything about the chauffeur. And their positions are different, but they develop some friendship. That's some example. Or, you know, amongst you, it's as students, besides you pick up somebody's eraser or pen or paper, you have some conversation after class, and you go have lunch together, and you develop a friendship. You're not just neutral or some little service, but friendship. And then comes a fourth category of parental, or you're looking after the needs of another. You're helping to extend care for a dependent. Obviously, an example of that is a child and their parent, but there are some relationships that have that element or that character of love. For one is like a big brother looking after a younger brother kind of thing. Or a friend that is looking after someone who's in the hospital or in some difficult condition or something like that. So there's another character of love. And then conjugal love. So according to the Vedic literature, these are different characters of love. Characteristics. And then following them, there's the secondary ones. And so when there's a slight adjustment of mood, a friend or a lover and beloved might have some, you know, little episode of ghastliness in that relationship, and then it gets back to conjugal kind of a mood. So I like that. So the secondary ones may sometimes eclipse the primary ones, but the primary ones remain primary even when the secondary one seems to be prominent, unless the primary one breaks or something like that. So that's character, now comes quality. So this is a little challenging subject, but according to the Vedic literature, there's pure and impure qualities of love. And what's the basis of pure or impure? And the Vedic wisdom says, when there's knowledge of both subject and object, then there's the possibility of pure. And the converse is, if you don't have a clue about the other person, then how can you have a pure relationship with the other person? So we're up on the ceiling here with this, but wrong knowledge identifies the subject or the object with something that they aren't, the body or the mind, and it results in an impure quality of love. This is an important item, so I'll spend a little more time on it. Supposing I'm getting to know somebody, and I have a mistaken understanding of that somebody, and I start to relate to them according to that mistaken understanding. they're not going to be satisfied. I'm not going to be satisfied, although maybe intention is good. I'm not going to be satisfied either. And it's going to be a not a strong connect in that relationship. So fundamental to the Vedic picture of relationships and Vedic picture of a person, we had this really nice experience at MIT yesterday evening with a girl from Iran who wanted to know, we were speaking about the soul, and she said, you know, I'm a new person here. Can you describe what is the soul? I mean, it's not like, I didn't assume that she'd never heard of what a soul is before, but probably her perspective is different than what I'm accustomed to. So we spoke about that for some time. That's who we really are, is this tiny spiritual particle or spark of life within. And then that spark of life within has coverings. It has a gross one, this physical body, and it has a subtle one, another physical but subtle physical body, mind, intelligence, and false ego. And conceptions of who we are commonly are in one of those categories, but not the spiritual spark of life within. We're identifying with, there's Radha, little girl, smiling, very happy to have her name called. And, you know, I remember when Radha was smaller than she is now, and kind of squirmy and wouldn't sit still. And, you know, but, you know, a happy little girl. And then one day she's going to be like, you know, some of the women here, going to school and going to college and getting her degree and being cool Radha. So, but that's the body. But inside the body, there's something that's animating the body. There's a spirit soul, fortunately. And then, so one might identify with the body. You know, we've got this kind of that kind of the other kind. And then similarly with the mind and intelligence. And then our dear friend, false ego. So there are coverings that are who we aren't. And we tend to identify with who we aren't as opposed to who we are. And then we try to have a relationship with a sense of who we aren't with another person who they aren't. And it you know, it's a little uncomfortable. It doesn't work so well. And that gets, so that's a wrong kind of a quality of relationship. And where do we get such quality of understandings of self and each other? You know, just get born and live in the world for a while. Like I just finished some travel. I was in India for a while. I went to Singapore for a while. You know, each time you go into a place, to get a visa, and you know, there's all these, you know, who are you questions. What's your name? What's your address? What's your color of hair? What's your color of eyes? Where were you born? Who are you? You know, so it's all in terms of the body. Or maybe you made your application for school by saying, here's my grade point average, here's what I got on my SATs, and this is my mind and my intellect. That's who I am. But that's not who we are. I mean, those are maybe credentials that you have, but it's not the identity. And the world in which we live reinforces who we aren't, as opposed to who we are. And then we try to have relationships with one another. Then there's another kind of understanding. It's also running across the ceiling here. When the subject and the object are identified as the soul, not the coverings of the soul. And then what do souls do? Well, Vedic literature is very clear. The souls serve constitutionally. Try to think of somebody, and the answer is you won't be able to think of somebody that isn't serving somebody. Whoever you are, whoever anybody is, constitutionally we serve. You know, the president is serving the country, and the faculty members here are serving the students, and everyone's serving somebody, many somebodies, because that's what souls do, according to the Vedic literature, and according to our practical experience. Where do we get that knowledge? Well, scriptures teach it about the soul different than the body, and what souls do. And it's available in all non-sectarian and transcendental religious teachings. So this is like a refresh. Pure relationships result from knowledge of spiritual identity. Impure relationships result from ignorance of our real identity. Somebody might say, well, can't you have pure love from some other kind of source, like really not knowing who you are and who the other person is, and can't you still have a pure relationship? Well, the assertion here is no, that we need this knowledge of self-identity, and naturally that helps awaken pure love. And the converse is also there, not knowing who we are or the other person is. When our real identities are unknown, things remain impure. Well, somebody might argue, relationships based on the body, they can work, even if you don't know who the other person is. You have a wrong idea of who the other person is. You think of them in terms of the body. Can't you still have like a pure relationship? This is a generic kind of a question. And here's some statistics. Of course, they're a little old, but you know, the picture's not so far. In the United States in the year 2009, this year statistics that come every couple of years, so I think I need to update it. In 2009, 2 million marriages took place in America, and 35% of them ended up in divorce within 15 years, and 3.5 divorces within 1 year out of 1,000 marriages. So it's not like people said, hey, I've got a great idea. What's that? Let's get married, and then we'll get divorced. Hey, that's a great idea. Let's do that. That's not where it starts out, but statistics show that's what happens. And then we'll take a look at births. Wow, look at all those births for how many marriages? 4,309,000 live births. But at the same time, nearly a million spontaneous abortions and 1.2 procured abortions, 28% out of 100. So it's not like, hey, I've got a great idea. Yeah, what's that? Let's produce a child and then kill the child. Yeah, that's a great idea. Let's do that. So it doesn't start out with that intention, but it can end up like that statistically. Then another is recognized crimes against persons and against property. A whole lot against property, but a whole lot against persons also. Average of 3,858 crimes against persons in the USA every day. So it's not like people said, hey, I've got a great idea. Let's get together and live together and then have crime with one another. Hey, that's a great idea. Let's do that. That's not why people come together. The intention isn't violence and crime. People watch too many movies and see so much violence so they become violent and do violent things. Or this is one a little closer to home. Relationship violence in colleges. I forget which university I was attending, and it was a whole week dedicated to relationship violence on campus. They had like posters, boo on relationship violence, because it was a problem. You know, primarily women being the victims, but not always women being the victims, just in relationships, people go on a date, and at the end of the date, there's violence, or at the end of a relationship on among students. It's a problem. And here's a statistic, Archives of Pediatrics. All forms of relationship violence are prevalent amongst male and female college students. Almost half of students had experienced relationship violence at some point in their lives. More than one-third had experienced violence before college, and one-quarter had experienced violence during college. So again, let's have a relationship so we can have violence together. That's not, I mean, some people are predatorial and that's really what's in their mind, but that's not generally where it starts. But there's problems with relationships that are based on not a proper conception of ourselves and the other person. So here's a little summary. When there's a relationship between one temporary limited body and another temporary limited body, likely we're going to end up with a temporary limited relationship, call it love or whatever. Alternatively, there's an exchange of love between one eternal powerful soul and another eternal powerful soul. Seeing one another in that way, then much more likely a lasting powerful relationship. So we're almost done. And now there's one other piece that's needs to be in this puzzle here, and that's what's the position of God in a loving relationship, a pure loving relationship. Somebody might ask, isn't it possible to exclude God? This is something we discussed at MIT. Ethics and morality minus God, called agnosticism. Ethical agnosticism. Isn't it possible? So the reply from the Vedic wisdom is no, because God is already there. How can you exclude He who is already there? Within, according to the Vedic wisdom, within every atom, a particle of matter, and within the heart of every living being, this is an illustration from Bhagavad Gita, where it says a pundit, you've heard that word? Pandit, pandita samadarshana. A learned person is one who sees equally an elephant, a dog, a dog eater, a cow, and a learned Brahmin. Well, the bodily forms are obviously different, but there's something inside that's the same. And one can see the inside, the spiritual quality inside, the coverings are different, but there's a sameness or there's a unity within all life. And seeing in that way the presence of God within the heart of every living being, then there's naturally a reverence and respect for all forms of life. So here's how it works. There's relationships that are neutral, service, friend, parental, and conjugal relationships. That now there's, in those relationships, there's something that's shared by them. And that is, God's at the center. Or He's the common object of love amongst the subject and object. And to illustrate this, a couple little pictures. To make a tree supplied with water, you put water on the roots, and that automatically the water goes to the trunk and the branches and the leaves and the fruits and all the different parts of the tree. Just by one thing, by watering the root of the tree. Similarly, in relationships, this picture shows God at the center, and then we have persons who are guiding us spiritually. We have our family members and extended family and society, and in all those cases, the circle of relationships, God's at the center. And here's an illustration that is important to me. Let me share. I first met, as we were coming from the car, someone was helping you get here, and they said, you know, how did you get started in Krishna consciousness? So I said, like you, I was in college, and Prabhupada, my spiritual master later on, came on tour in the college I was attending, and he was traveling with Allen Ginsberg, then a famous American poet, and Allen Ginsberg liked mantra meditation, so he and Prabhupada were chanting Hare Krishna mantra together on stage in at our student union room, and I went inside and, you know, participated in the kirtan, the chanting, just like you're doing, and at the end Prabhupada spoke, and then it was over. We went and took a vegetarian meal, like you're going to do later too. And then he invited us to, participants to come to the center that was across the street from the campus. So I didn't go, I was kind of shy and like, I don't know what else. It was just like a new experience. But the first time I did hear him speak, he spoke about the following. And that's what this image is. He went like this, like imagine there's a pool of water, and we give each person in the room a little stone or pebble. And we ask, you know, could you put your stone or pebble into the pool and let's see what happens. And this is what happens. A little boop and splash and concentric circles go out, and it looks very nice. Okay. Now, can you put your stone or pebble in the water, and same thing happens, and it's very nice until the concentric circles intersect and then they clash. And then we say, okay, on the count of three, everyone throw your stone or pebble into the water. What happens? And it's a big mess on the surface of the water. Then he said, supposing, instead of just everybody throw their pebbles in the water, we agree on a common place, we place our stone or pebble on that common place, and what happens? There's concentric circles, but they amplify one another. There's not a clash. So when there's agreed upon center, then it diminishes the clash or the conflict of the diversity of individuality. So that's called communal living. And, you know, different persons, I'll share something. In the 60s, when I was going to college, communes was like a big thing. And some of them lasted a long time, most of them didn't. And they didn't because the center was artificial. So, some few years ago, I was riding a train, an Amtrak, from New York City to go to our farm community in Pennsylvania. You know, first, you know, go to Harrisburg, then to the farm. So this is anecdotal, but you get the picture. The train that goes to Harrisburg stops in Philadelphia South Street Station. A bunch of people get off, a bunch of people get on. I was seated at an aisle seat. The train started filling up. There was a lady that, you know, saw me sitting there and, you know, says, is there anybody in that empty spot? So she sat in the empty spot. And I was busy doing my thing, you know, studying and email and my thing. And she was one of these ladies that I could feel it. She wanted to talk. You know what I mean? So she said, you know, we're heading towards Harrisburg, pull out of South Street Station. And she said, are you part of a commune? And I said, well, yeah. And she said, I was part of a commune too. She wanted to talk. I said, okay. You know, what can you tell me about it? What commune were you with? I was with a commune in West Virginia. And I thought, wow, because we have a commune in West Virginia. We have a farm community in Moundsville, West Virginia. I said, you know, where in West Virginia? She said something, something. So I knew that it wasn't the same one. And so tell me about it, because she wanted to tell me about it. So she said, well, it was some kind of commune where we had these ideals about living off the land and do-do-do-do-do. And then, you know, then it didn't last very long. So what happened? Well, the people that came together with that center gradually had different ideas of what the center should be. And some people broke off and some people broke off, and then the commune split up. So I said, well, then what happened? I went and joined another commune in New York. It was a yoga community, and I learned yoga. Now I became a yoga teacher. And after becoming a yoga teacher, I moved to Philadelphia and was teaching yoga. So that's like her little life story. And then she said, well, what about your commune? So I said, well, you know, here's the difference. The commune that I'm going to visit has been around for about almost 50 years. And it's still thriving. It's a really fantastic place. And you know why? Why it's still there and it didn't like dissipate like that one that you started up in West Virginia or joined in West Virginia? Because God's at the center. It's still there. And there's still people who are God-centered and living that kind of a life. So it wasn't arbitrary. But when you don't have God at the center, you have this conflict, inevitable conflict in relationships, and people have their differences, and, you know, small scale and large scale of differences. Think about, you know, situations in the current events of world history, all over the world, all kinds of things like this, because there's a different center without God at the center. That's what we want. We want this one. So in the currency of relationships, we want some exchange of emotion that you know, we all value. We all want to love, and we all want to be loved. That's universal everywhere, in any language, in any culture in the world. It's something we value. And to have it effective, we have to understand the other person. And it really helps if we understand ourselves too, and you know who we are, and then from that position of understanding who we are, appreciating who the other person is, and placing God at the center. So, is it possible? You have to have this kind or that kind of. Is it branded and there's a franchise on it? It's only certain people, exclusively, sectarian-wise, can have such a thing? And the answer is no. But there's some fundamental principles that need to be recognized. One, the first one is we're soul, not the body. And what's the body? The body is a covering of the soul. And God is the supreme person above both the covering of the soul and all souls. And we're all his servants and he's the master. So I've summarized the understandings that are found in Bhagavad Gita, and I think you've probably spoken about Bhagavad Gita in the course of your club's activities here. And the ideas are beyond sectarian ideas, gender-based, ethnic. You know, you got to be something before you can be, you know, a card-carrying member. Not like that at all. It's actually an appeal or a teaching that says how to have genuine, loving relationships in our lives. And this is the last slide. You can't see it across the top because it's running across the ceiling, but this is from Mother Teresa's home for children in Calcutta. And somebody shared this with me because they're devotees like I am, but unlike me, they have a very, very special skill of family counseling. In fact, they're like very, very skilled at it. And there's a married couple. I know the husband and the wife very well, and they're both wonderful people, and they were having a relationship problem after they got married. Surprise! A relationship problem. And they tried this and tried that and the other thing, and, you know, the relationship wasn't getting better. And after spending some time with this one individual, Mantrini is her name, and after spending time with Mantrini, the relationship got really nice. And so I said, Mantrini, you know, fantastic. Whatever you did, fantastic. He said, all I did was just remind them of this thing at the bottom. I shared with them what Mother Teresa has on her wall in Calcutta. So I'm going to read it, but the emphasis is on the bottom one. So, people are often unreasonable, irrational, and self-centered. Forgive them anyway. If you are kind, people may accuse you of selfish ulterior motives. Be kind anyway. If you are successful, you'll win some unfaithful friends and some genuine enemies. Succeed anyway. If you are honest and sincere, people may deceive you. Be honest and sincere anyway. What you spend years creating, others could destroy overnight. Create anyway. If you find serenity and happiness, some will be jealous. Be happy anyway. The good you do today will often be forgotten. Do good anyway. Give the best you have, and it will never be enough. Give your best anyway. And then, in the final analysis, it is between you and God. It was never between you and them anyway. So she explained to this couple, what was the reason that you got married to one another? Because you had shared values and convictions and devotion to Krishna. And so there's this other thing going on between, you know, he's not this and she's not that, and, you know, that kind of thing. But it's really in that relationship between one and another, because they're good people. And they each know that they're good people, they're just good in a different way. And they want this kind of good, not that kind. You know how it is. So the real issue is, what mended the relationship is, the real purpose they came together was to serve Krishna together. So somehow Krishna disappeared, or the God-centered aspect of the relationship disappeared, and then it became about, you know, their differences, instead of God at the center, serving him together. And now, for the last 8 years, it's fantastic. I'm sure they have little bumps, but it's not like it was. So, with God, conclusion. God at the center, seeing one another, although bodies are different and minds are different and cultures are different and languages may be different and so on. But inside, there's a spirit soul. And we shouldn't forget the spirit soul reality of the other persons who we're interacting with. And we can learn how to exchange affection and emotion with one another in various ways that's satisfying with one another, respecting one another like that, and needs and so forth. But with the spiritual conception and with God at the center, then one can have pure and sustainable, lasting relationships. Genuine, loving relationships, which we all want. We all want to love and be loved. And that's the Vedic wisdom's recommendation of how to achieve it. And last. And I don't have a sound amplification, so you can have this in music. And this is a little video clip. So watch here, but the sound won't be so distinct. Sorry, not prepared. Okay.
Thank you, sir.
The creator of that little video clip is sitting right over here. Krishnapriya. Is that any comments? Do we have time for questions? You have time?
Yes.
Any thoughts you want to share or anything on this? Yes.
Yeah. So, when we're relating with people other than ourselves, do we need this conceptual idea of them being, having that spiritual spark, and that's all? Or do we kind of develop the heartfelt warmth towards them?
That starts, yes, both. Mm-hmm. But heartfelt, we wish to have heartfelt warmth, and the recommendation being made here is repose it on the person. So it starts with who is the person, and then the heartfelt warmth naturally comes. It naturally comes. It's far stronger than, you know, otherwise. Naturally it comes.
Thank you.
Yes.
Talking about souls and to identify the soul when you interact with a person, I was under the assumption that when you come into this material world, you have so many layers of materialism over you.
That's not it's a correct assumption, not a false one.
How do, I mean, it's kind of related to this question. When it's like so much covered by all these materialistic things, how do you actually identify that what the actual person is? Because your assumptions are based on the covers.
Okay. Here's Radha again. Smiling Radha. And, you know, in a little package, she can be explosive. Have you seen? I have. She's as sweet as can be. And she can be, you know, explosive. But that's not, you know, so that's, you know, that's in the little package, and now then she's going to become, in a bigger form. Animating all of that is a spirit soul. And, you know, form may change, personality may become a little different, and those kinds of things. So when I'm relating to Radha, as I'm doing right now, and she's smiling, I can see her for the coverings, and the changing of those coverings, but also the spirit soul at the same time. When there are relationships that I have with people, I'm just speaking first person, that I've seen go through all kinds of stuff. And I've said to them, when you're going through your stuff, some of the stuff that you're going through, I don't like. But, you know, I don't identify the stuff with you. I know you. And, you know, the relationship that I have is with you. And I'm very contented with being in that relationship with you. And I'm also contented in saying, when stuff goes on, you know, it's not pleasing. But I'm not judging you, just, you know, because I know who you are. And so there's acceptance of the person because of that steadiness of the commitment to the person. On the deeper level of who the person is, it has helped some of those individuals, many of those individuals, to stabilize and, you know, get a hold of themselves on the stuff that gets, you know, out of hand sometimes, and come back to, you know, being more of a balanced person and managing their lives better and be happier as a result. Even with that, that's still like coverings. So it's not really yet, you know, the full enlightenment of the individual as a spirit soul. But it helps in the relationship to see the spirit soul and not, you know, the coverings are there and the nature of those coverings can be what they are. One can recognize what they are. That's fine. Like that example of the pundit seeing equally the elephant, the dog eater, the cow, the learned Brahmin. Coverings are different. And because the coverings are different, I may express myself in a different way with different souls with different coverings. Still, I can recognize there's a spirit soul within. And on a deeper level, recognize the spirit soul within and relate on the spirit soul level in our common service to God. At the same time, honoring the differences and the uniquenesses of the person and the layers of covering, like you put it. Like you. Layers of covering, fine. Spirit soul, fantastic. And God's in the picture, super fantastic. And you're on a path, you know, with the coverings and the spirit soul's attraction to God, that's unique. Fantastic. And then, so then there can be the basis of a relationship that's acknowledging the differences in the coverings and the layers. But beneath it all is the spirit soul that has this eternal, innate, loving attraction for the Supreme. Then there can be a loving, the point of this is, then there can be a loving relationship that's satisfying and meaningful for both parties, or, you know, multiple parties. And as the, you know, the preface that Partha was putting at the beginning was, then with the object, you know, the spirit soul and spirit soul seeing one another as spirit soul, it's elevating and purifying, and one gets closer to that, you know, becoming freed from the coverings, the layers and layers and layers of coverings. We've got a long way to go, but we can get closer to that through those loving relationships. That's most important in our life. That's the message. Yes.
So it's, you know, pretty difficult not to get sort of tied down to those old, listening to a presentation like this basically is it's like, oh yeah, that's where I messed up. It's like it's all so clear, I was evaluating basically some of the relationships in my life that I hold most dear, and a lot of it was in my family, longtime friends that maybe have dropped out of contact somewhat, uh-huh. And you know, my desire is to go out of the room and like make phone calls for the next like 3 or 4 hours, you know, and like wake my mom up. It's like, you know that I love you, right? And, like, so basically, the point of me sharing this is sort of you know, when you do kind of snap out of that zone for a second and you kind of remember really what's important. It's, I guess, it's kind of how to then act on that without creeping somebody up. Like, what are you showering me with all this love for? I don't know, or I haven't heard from you in like 2 years. And, you know, so not that it's coming from a place of being misunderstood. I'm sure people would appreciate that kind of thing, but I didn't sort of amend previous, you know.
You just shared, let me share. I when I was in India, I spent time with this couple the husband from Australia, and I hadn't heard from him in a while, and the reason I hadn't heard from him in a while, I found out when we were together. and that is he was having a marital problem. And the marital problem was his business takes him traveling, and he had been away for the last 5 years, for like half a year. And his wife, he was taking the relationship for granted, but then his wife was quietly having a problem. Not exactly with the relationship, but with something else in her life. But he wasn't around for her to share that something else, and so she kind of crumbled inside. And then next, concentric circle out, was it damaged the relationship because, you know, you weren't there for me. So he shared a realization. It was like a trauma for him to realize, I've neglected my wife. And I love my wife. And my wife loves me, but, you know, I neglected her. I was just taking it for granted. And so the whole thing could have played out a whole lot differently if I had invested more in the relationship over those 5 years that I was off busy doing important things, providing for the family and, you know, etc. So I shared with him 3 times after he shared that with me, what you just said, like, you know, I need to do a reset on, I'm a busy person. I got things, ask the people that know me, I'm a busy person. While being busy, I may do the same thing, and take relationships for granted and just, you know, zoom and take care of things, do things and important things. But then there's relationships. So my response, personal, is just place it in a priority position. And the things that can be investments in the relationships need not necessarily be hours of phone calls. It can be a gesture that says to the person, like what the presentation says, an exchange of emotion, of affection, of concern and care. It doesn't have to be a volume thing, it's just a quality thing. And make it part of your life, that not just like an outburst, but as a part that's you. You value relationships and you're investing in those relationships that are important to you. Not necessarily in volumes and volumes, but, you know, in genuine expressions. That's to expect that you're Superman. And you're going to be like, you know, with everybody all the time, all over the place, and still, you know, live your life and be a student and all the other things. But, you know, consciously, you invest in those relationships in a quality way. And be consistent with it. It certainly helps if you have a spiritual conception of yourself and the other person from this presentation, and work on that. And that will help the quality of the exchange. And if consciousness of God is at the center of that exchange, subject and object are both serving God, and we acknowledge that, that makes the relationship even more super, or surcharged, or spiritually energized and satisfying. And work on that too. But, you know, it's not like you can tell your mom, hey, you know, get more spiritual, mom. It's get more spiritual self, and then in my exchanges with mom, it's going to be like, wow, what's happening with my son here? He's like becoming really, you know, I don't know exactly what, but I like it. And then she'll ask you, what's going on? Well, you know. I go to this thing on Tuesday and like, it's really nice. And I'm learning more about, you know, my own spirituality. Well, however you want to say it. Without like pushing. Just being. And it's effective. It's contagious. Anything else? Okay. We're done. Thank you very much.